Thanks for joining us, everyone. My name is Ryan Walsh. I'm a partner at Eimer Stahl in our Madison office, and it's my pleasure to moderate this panel today on a very important issue. Despite several high court decisions in recent terms, settling some recurring issues in political and election law, many questions remain unanswered. And since the virus hit, many new ones have risen. As both Republicans and Democrats prepare for what both sides call the most important election in our lifetime, though, let's be real, isn't that what we say about every presidential election? All eyes are turning to the courts, for better or worse. We'll focus on a few of those questions this afternoon. First, several states are removing voters from their rolls in preparation for the 2020 elections. Critics say voters are being unfairly purged, but states say they're cleaning up the lists. Some litigants say that too, including one on our call today. What limits do state and federal law put on rules governing maintenance of voter lists, voter rolls? Second, last term in Rucho versus Common Cause, the Supreme Court held that partisan gerrymandering claims are non-justiciable political questions, and therefore federal courts do not have jurisdiction to resolve them. What, if anything, should policymakers do to address districts drawn through partisan gerrymanders? What can we expect of the state courts in this area? Three, with all the clamor about Russia and China's attempts to undermine the integrity of our elections, how secure from hacking are the electronic systems used to count votes? Four, what is dark money, a thing we hear about in the media all the time, and what problems, if any, does it pose to democratic elections? Last but not least, what does a lawful, fully constitutional voting process look like during a pandemic? When, if ever, should elections be delayed, so long as the virus remains with us? Just a few small questions that our panelists today, who are very distinguished lawyers in Wisconsin, are going to settle for us. Rick Essenberg is the founder and current president and general counsel of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Rick is a frequent litigator in state and federal courts and a nationally recognized scholar and commentator on constitutional law, particularly the First Amendment, but also a lot. Marquette University Law School. Rick's scholarship has appeared in numerous publications. He holds a JD, magna cum laude, from Harvard Law School, where he was an editor of the Harvard Law Review. It says my internet is unstable. Can you all hear me?
Yep.
Okay. Magna cum laude from Harvard Law School. He was an editor of the Harvard Law Review, and he received a BA summa cum laude from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. He was formerly a litigation partner and a general counsel at a manufacturing firm. Lester Pines is a senior partner at and one of the founders of Pines Bach Law Firm. A fellow of the American College of Trial Lawyers, Lester is an accomplished advocate who concentrates his practice on civil and criminal trials, arbitrations, and civil appeals. For over 46 years, he has appeared in state and federal trial courts and before the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, State Supreme Court, and the Seventh Circuit. Among other areas, Lester has for many years been a go-to attorney in Wisconsin on matters of political and election law. He got both his degrees from the University of Wisconsin in Madison, finishing his undergraduate studies with distinction in history. So before I turn it over to our panelists, first a note on structure. Rick and Lester will each give an opening statement of sorts, going for about 10 to 15 minutes each. As they're speaking, feel free to submit questions as you're listening. Those questions will be viewable by the panelists, but my understanding is that no one else will see them. While you're submitting questions, and as the speakers are finishing up, I will ask a few questions myself, and then I will select from some of the questions that you all have asked. And one last note, don't forget to tune in to tomorrow's panel, this time tomorrow, on nationwide injunctions. It should be great. I'm really looking forward to it. Okay, with all of that out of the way, I'm happy to turn things over to Rick Essenberg. Rick?
Well, thanks, Ryan. It's great to be here this afternoon. I'm experimenting with Zoom settings here, and I'm not quite satisfied with this one, but Lester should be, because I think he kind of sees me as looming in the dark all the time, and so I'm happy to confirm that for him. We live in a very polarized time, and it's fraught with suspicion and distrust. And concerns about voter fraud on the one hand and voter suppression on the other, I think are an odd combination of a sincere belief in political strategy. But putting aside the latter, I think that Republicans, for the most part, really do believe that voter fraud is a serious problem that needs to be addressed. And I am sure that Democrats really believe that voter suppression is a real problem that needs to be addressed. And so the question that I think we should concern ourselves with here is what is the path through these two seemingly irreconcilable tendencies? Now, what we like to say is that voting should be easy, no harder than it needs to be, and fraud should be difficult. That is, it should be deterred by reasonable rules and regulations about ballot security and deterrence of improper behavior. The need for the latter, right, the need to be concerned about ballot security and improper behavior is not, I think, dissipated by the strange assertion that when it comes to elections, fraud never happens. In almost every field of human endeavor, some people will cheat, right? They cheat on their taxes, they cheat on their spouses, they cheat on any number of things. And when we have elections which are seen by voters as existential events, as Flight 93 elections, or as elections where if the wrong person wins, some actor is going to leave the country, it seems to me not implausible to think that there will be some incentive to improper behavior. And of course, I think history does tell us that that it's a possibility. How did the city of Chicago become famous? Real Clear Politics recently had a piece which outlined a variety of instances of, recent cases of improper election behavior. Recently had an election set aside in Paterson, New Jersey. In the last congressional election cycle, North Carolina 9, that election was invalidated due to improper ballot harvesting. And so it's something that we need to keep in our minds, not only because of its intrinsic value, and we should try to ensure that elections are fair. As Judge Posner told us in the lower court opinion in Crawford years ago, when it comes to efforts to police voter fraud, voting rights are on both sides of the ballot, the balance. If in fact a vote is improperly cast, it cancels out a vote that is properly cast. If you don't believe that is of significance, think of the rationale in the one person, one vote cases in Baker versus Karn and Reynolds versus Sim, where the concept was recognized that if something improper happens that dilutes the impact of someone's vote, then there is either a denial of equal protection or an impairment of what might be a fundamental right. So I think it's a curious ideology to say that voting is a sacred and all important right, but that we ought to do almost nothing in order to ensure the deterrence of fraud and the fairness of outcomes. And so I begin with the notion that the law ought to recognize, and I think it does recognize, that reasonable steps can be taken to deter voter fraud and to enhance public confidence in the outcome of our elections, particularly at a time like today when there is a great deal of polarization and both sides are absolutely convinced that the other side is going to steal the election or refuse to concede if they do not win. And I think that we tend to view these things you know, through the Anderson verdict test. It's often used in federal constitutional challenges to impairment of voting rights. In my view, that test has become too fuzzy, in which it essentially says, look, we're gonna consider any and every impairment, and by impairment we mean something that makes things a little bit harder. On the exercise of voting rights, we're going to balance that against the state interest and the legitimacy of the state interest that's asserted, and then we're going to come up with some type of an outcome. Justice Scalia saw it a little differently. Justice Scalia saw that it should be less of a dimmer switch, less of something which allows courts to find constitutional violations based upon any type of impairment, no matter really how trivial, which I think has led to a typical strategy in these cases where one attempts to find an eggshell voter who would be impaired or significantly inconvenienced by a restriction, and then use that as a justification for invalidating that restriction as to all voters. Scalia saw it more as an on-off switch, that the question really was whether the state was doing something that surpassed a threshold of reasonableness. And he did that in part because, when you have essentially unburdened balancing tests that are uncabined, that maximize judicial discretion, then you maximize the possibility for the personal preferences of judges to creep into the balance. Now, what we've done in order to ensure that there be some public confidence in our elections is attempt to support what we think are relatively reasonable and modest restrictions, or not restrictions, but efforts to preserve ballot security and deter fraud. I think that there is a false debate that's going on in the country right now, and that is about whether or not we're going to have voting by mail. We're not going to have all mail-in elections. That's not going to happen, and in fact, that shouldn't happen. There's absolutely no way that any state in the country that doesn't have an all-mail election right now could possibly have it by November. I mean, it is a very substantial undertaking. It's something that takes years to put into place, and it ought not to be attempted now. But we are going to have a lot of voting by mail. And the reason that we're going to have a lot of voting by mail is that 34 states in the District of Columbia permit, for lack of a better word, no excuse absentee voting. Right? You don't have to say why it is that you're voting absentee. And in virtually all those states, you can vote by mail. Here in Wisconsin, in the 2016 election cycle, we had about 27% of all votes were cast absentee in that cycle. In the April cycle, we had over 70% of votes that were cast by mail. And think about what happened in April. When early voting started in April, there wasn't a great deal of concern about the COVID pandemic. This is an election that fundamentally transformed itself while the voting was going on. And personally, I think that in terms of handling absentee ballots, clerks probably did a pretty good job, given the way that thing changed late in the election cycle. They ought to be able to do a better job this time, and they ought to do a better job of handling in-person voting. I mean, it was absolutely a crime that the city of Milwaukee had 5 polling places open in April of this year. There's absolutely no excuse for that. Throughout the city of Milwaukee, there were hardware stores and grocery stores that were fully staffed at the height of the pandemic, and the notion that one could not have more than 5 polling places open, I think, is just incredible on its face. But what we've done is we've said, look, if we're going to have more voting by mail, then it's very important to have accurate voter rolls. When you have voting by mail, it's certainly possible it can be done, but think about it. The voting process is removed from the scrutiny of an election official. Ballots are now sent around the state. They are filled out without supervision, and they are returned without supervision. And in order to ensure that we have some measure of ballot security, it's important that registration rolls be accurate. That's why we have registration. Well, we don't do a very good job of that in this country. According to the nonprofit Pew Charitable Trust, about 1 in 8 voter registrations are inaccurate in some significant way. And one of the ways that that happens is people move. And when they move, they don't go back to the municipality where they moved from and say, look, I've moved, take me off the voter rolls. And so in order to do that, the state of Wisconsin participates in a consortium called ERIC. ERIC does a data matching analysis. The data matching is done based upon information that the voters themselves provide to a state government. In a state government transaction, they give an address other than one that they are registered to vote on. That's the only way you get on this movers list. And it seems to me under those circumstances that that movers list is substantially accurate. We think 95 to 97%. And what state law requires, we believe, the Wisconsin Election Commission to do is follow a process which is outlined in which people are provided with notice. The notice says, we think you've moved. If you have moved, you have to re-register at your new address. And if you haven't moved, just send this postcard back to us, or your registration will be deactivated. Now, there are many opportunities, if you overlook that postcard, for you to register to vote. The parties will be looking for you. You can register by mail. You can register online. You can even register at the polling place on the day of the election. And all you have to do is provide proof of residence, which most people, if they haven't moved, will have because it's a photo ID state and they're going to have a driver's license. It's not a perfect system, but it seems to me to be a reasonable system and not one that results in the suppression of votes on any partisan basis. My understanding is that the way that you might be on this movers list inaccurately is if you register a vehicle at your business, or if you register a vehicle at your vacation home, or if you purchase an automobile for your college-age child and you register at her place where she goes to school and not where you live. I don't know how those people will vote. I'm fairly certain, though, that they're not low-income people. So we think this is a reasonable effort. That case is going to be argued before the state Supreme Court later this month. The other thing that we've done is we've asked the Wisconsin Election Commission to make clear that ballot harvesting is not permitted in this state. Now, you know, the state law arguably doesn't explicitly address ballot harvesting. I think that ballot harvesting is nevertheless prohibited because it does talk about the request and the return of ballots by the voters. Now, the problem with ballot harvesting is not, it isn't, the problem here is not that, you know, your spouse might return, you know, drop your ballot in the mail for you. That's not what happens. It might happen, but that's not what people worry about. What people worry about is partisans collecting ballots, requesting ballots on the part of people, helping people to fill them out, and then deciding whether or not to return them. That is an occasion of political sin, and we saw it in North Carolina 9 in 2018. And incidentally, it was Republican activists that were the culprits there, and allegations that they put pressure on voters, allegations that if they thought the voter had voted the wrong way, they wouldn't return the ballot. That's something that we needn't permit in this state. That's the type of thing, particularly when we have these ballots streaming in after election night, that undermines public confidence in the system. And so, we're going to have voting by mail. If we want to both protect the right to vote and protect public confidence in the process, then having some reasonable ballot security measures, including some of the ones that are provided by law, like, you know, witnessing and the use of a voter ID and having an end date, right, where there's a date by which you have to vote or your vote will not count. And there has to be some way to determine that by, for example, postmark or something else, that these things are all things that are important to ensure that we have an outcome. And we don't have the type of division and accusations that both parties, incidentally, both Republicans and Democrats seem to think are inevitable.
Okay, thanks, Rick. Let's hear from Lester now. Lester? You're still on mute, Lester.
Sorry, I was muted. As I was talking to Ryan before we started, and I shared that when I first started practicing law, I had a portable manual typewriter on my desk. So I've come a long way. I apologize for unmuting. Now I've got it. I'm very pleased to have an opportunity to address the group and to talk about these issues. I want to just take a step back and talk about the right to vote in general and its development. First of all, the right to vote is not guaranteed by the United States Constitution. I think we know that. All of us know that. The right to vote is guaranteed in Wisconsin by the Wisconsin Constitution. Very strict rules in the Constitution about voting. Many of you may not know that before voter registration was allowed in Wisconsin, there had to be an amendment to the Constitution. Everyone in Wisconsin who is an adult, who's not under supervision or incarcerated for a felony, has the right to vote. It's guaranteed. Historically, as we know, from the beginning of our country, white men were allowed to vote if they owned property. That developed, required a civil war and the 15th Amendment to allow black men to vote, and the 20th Amendment, excuse me, the 19th Amendment to allow women the right to vote. And it wasn't until the Voting Rights Act in 1965 that most black people were allowed to vote in many states. There has been a long development of the right to vote. The idea that some people can vote and other people can't vote or aren't allowed to vote was where we started, and we've developed. Now the question is, I think, how do we make the ability to vote accessible to everyone? The United States has low voter turnout compared to many other democratic countries in the world. Why is that? What do we do here that keeps people from voting? Well, one of the things I'd like to suggest is that we don't pay enough attention to the difficulty there is to voting when you're not a person who has a lot of time and flexibility. It is difficult for some people to vote on election day. The reason it's difficult is they have to work. Election day isn't a holiday. They don't know what their work schedule might be. There are many, many people who don't know their work schedule from one day to the next, from one week to the next, I should say. Their lives are not that organized. There are many competing pressures on them. I'm talking specifically about working people who are low-income people. So election day elections are many times difficult for people in that circumstance. Wisconsin, we've done a good job of making it easier for people to vote in certain ways. Early voting is one way. Interestingly, the legislation that was just recently, after 3 years of waiting for a decision from the Seventh Circuit, found to be constitutional, was restricting early voting down to just 2 weeks before the election. There was an attempt to restrict the places where people could do early voting by limiting them to one place per county. these kinds of mechanisms are ones that we need to pay attention to. And on both sides of the aisle, regardless of what your party is, to say, that isn't what we want to do. We don't want to restrict making voting easier. We want to make voting easier. Personally, I think the national election days should be holidays so that people have an absolutely wide open time to go to the polls. I also think that there should be as many polling places as possible and that the funding for staffing those polling places should be made available. One thing that I'm confident about in Wisconsin is the way that we vote. When we actually go to the polling place and vote, I think it's quite secure because we're not voting with touchscreen machines for the most part. We're actually filling out paper ballots. We're putting them through a device which tabulates the ballot, which is not connected to the internet, and there are paper ballots available in every location that are maintained, so there's a way to check the count. Those are all really great things. With regard to voter ID, we have to recognize that voter ID in Wisconsin is one of the most restrictive voter ID places in the country. And it was difficult for many people to get voter IDs until the federal court litigation, which required the state to change certain aspects of how one applies for a voter ID through the Department of Transportation. But one thing you need to know is Department of Transportation offices have been closed. Department of Transportation offices have been moved. In Dane County, in Madison, the Department of Transportation offices are not on a public transportation route. So it's very difficult to get to. And that's an impediment. So what we should be doing in our state is to eliminate impediments for people to get their ID, eliminate impediments that keep people from voting in person, to eliminate any difficulties with regard to registration. Now, about the registration rules. We assume that people get postcards, read the postcards, know what they say, and so forth. If we think a person isn't an appropriately registered in an appropriate place, we ought to have more mechanisms for communicating with them. We ought to really communicate about it because it's a fundamental right. And we shouldn't just rely on a postcard to protect a fundamental right. And we say, well, you can register on election day. People don't necessarily know that they can go and re-register. I think that for our democracy, unrelated to partisan concerns, that every step that we can take to ensure that people are fully informed about their right to vote, fully informed of what they need to do, and that we fund elections and we fund election offices sufficiently to continually communicate with people about that issue. That's really what we need to do to make it the most possible for people to cast a ballot. Everyone should have that opportunity and that right. Now, one thing that we didn't talk about that I had prepared to talk about so far in this is about gerrymandering. And what does gerrymandering do about, what does it have to do with voting? Well, I think you probably all know the phrase that, you know, people should pick their representatives. Representatives shouldn't pick their voters. Gerrymandering has become a very sophisticated science. We can get down to block by block analysis of who votes. That's what happened after the 2010 election and when the 2010 census and subsequent gerrymandering. when you do gerrymandering on either side of the aisle, it makes elections less fair. That is, once a party has taken power and have a majority, if that party can then manipulate the districts in which people vote, that's a way of maintaining power that is unrelated to competitive elections. The U.S. Supreme Court has said, you know, there's nothing we can do about that. It's a political question, and it just has to be addressed politically. Well, that's a very interesting decision, and they've spoken. But the question I have is, if you have a majority that is gerrymandered and has the ability to gerrymander itself into a majority, how do you address that political question? How do you do it? It becomes virtually impossible to do it if the gerrymandered majority wants to continue to gerrymander. So I think what's going to happen is that over time, state courts are going to develop remedies for it. State courts are going to look at how do they enforce their own constitutions. Whether Wisconsin has the ability to do that through the state constitution, I doubt. Now, Rick has heard me say this before, there is a case, Reynolds versus Zimmerman, 1964, which said the legislature cannot redistrict through a joint resolution. Joint resolution is not subject to gubernatorial veto. That doesn't mean that this legislature couldn't say that it's going to redistrict through a joint resolution and then allow that to be litigated and try to overturn that 1964 decision. Whether they decide to do that or not, I don't know. But this upcoming redistricting is going to arguably be subject to gubernatorial veto if it's a gerrymander, an extreme gerrymander. That's the point at which the political effort by people, not just within the legislature and within the governor's office, but where people who are concerned about gerrymandering, that's the point at which they will have an opportunity to try to influence how the maps are drawn and to try to create competitive districts on both sides. And I will tell you, I don't have a concern about gerrymandering just because of what I've seen from the extreme gerrymandering from the Republican legislature. I believe that, in my view, when there are safe Democratic districts, I believe that the functioning of the Democrats is impaired just the way functioning of Republicans are impaired when they have safe districts. Because representatives don't function well unless there are people saying to them on both sides, this is what we want to do, and they try to deal with and respond to all of their constituents. I think that's how democracy is supposed to work. When you have districts where the representatives don't have to respond to all of their constituents, it begins to break the whole system down. So we'll see what happens in the upcoming redistricting. It's going to be interesting, and I know that there's also a petition before the Wisconsin Supreme Court for rulemaking to allow the Wisconsin Supreme Court to theoretically take over and write the maps. The justices before have rejected taking that on. I don't know what they're going to do this time. We have somewhat different court now. We'll see what happens. But to come back to what I'm saying, I don't think any of us should be afraid of making it as easy as possible for people to cast ballots. I will say, with regard to absentee ballots in Wisconsin, I don't know that we've had an issue with fraudulent absentee ballots. I haven't seen it, haven't heard about it. We've always had a tradition of clean government here. As more and more people start to cast ballots not at the polling place, I don't think we're going to run into a big problem because almost everybody is honest in the way they cast their ballot. It's not to say there isn't the danger of fraud. But right now, the way it works is someone has to witness your ballot, you have to seal it, you have to put it in the mail. Hopefully the mail works. So far, so good. We'll see what happens.
Well, thank you, Lester. Thank you, Rick. Just a reminder to the audience, feel free to submit questions, which I'll put to the panelists in a few minutes here. We have one so far. In the meantime, let me start with a question for Lester. Lester, you heard Rick say that he thinks the doctrine in election law is confused. It vests too much discretion in judges, whether elected or unelected. And he mentioned the Anderson-Burdick doctrine specifically, which basically is an undue burden test. It's pretty fuzzy. It's pretty open-ended. Are there any areas of election law doctrine that you, not from a policy perspective, but just from a legal perspective, you think need to be corrected so that there's maybe more predictability, maybe so that there's, maybe so that these cases have sort of a neutral, there's a neutral way to resolve them in a way that, the general perception is that it's Republicans versus Democrats and who are the judges, and therefore you kind of know how these cases are going to come out. Of course, that's not how we want the system to run. So give us your thoughts on how you, as a judge, would sort of reform this doctrine.
Well, I don't know the answer to your question. I will just say my experience has been that federal judges are very cautious about their decisions in election matters. In April, they're also restricted by the case law that says you can't make decisions too close to an election. When we litigated before Judge Connolly in late March over absentee ballots, I mean, that he was presented with a real crisis. We had this pandemic and people were afraid to go out, and he fashioned a remedy which seemed to work quite well. Now ultimately the Supreme Court modified it, but even with the modification that the Supreme Court of the Seventh Circuit made to his decision, it still led to a substantial number of people, 73,000 people, having their ballots counted where they would not otherwise have been counted because of the fear that people have of going out. And the fear was real at the time. I think the fear now is lessened, but I really gotten away from your question. I think that the law that really ought to govern, or I should say how the court approaches these election cases, is whether or not there is a significant burden on the right to vote caused by a reason, by a law. We go to the courts and we ask the courts to do those analyses in all kinds of different circumstances. I think we have to trust the courts will be cautious in them, and if they're not, as happened in April, the appellate court and the Supreme Court will modify those decisions. But that's my general thought about it. I really don't know what you would replace it with. Perhaps Rick has some ideas on that.
Yeah, Rick, feel free to respond to that. I'll also put a question to you. You can address whatever you want, whatever order you want. But it seems to me that there's a policy question looming now after Rucho, which is how ought state governments to handle the problem of partisan gerrymandering if we think it's a big problem rather than just a cost of democracy? How do you think legislators and state court judges should think about this problem? We know some states have quote unquote independent commissions that draw districts. We know in many states the lawmakers themselves try to draw it. There's a possibility you have state courts try to draw the maps in the first instance. How ought we to think about this debate?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the problem here is that throughout the litigation, which ultimately culminated in Russo, but you know, we had an earlier case coming out of Wisconsin, is that there was this assumption that people are able to draw districts in a way which effectively controls the outcomes of elections. I think that that's a proposition which is underdeveloped and ultimately not proven. I think that we ought to stop and pause and ask ourselves what political experts thought that Donald Trump was going to win the 2016 election. I don't think that there were very many. And I think so the ability to exercise that type of control may be exaggerated, but the whole issue is vexed because the measures which are typically used in order to show that there's a problem, right, the so-called efficiency gap, is really nothing more than a measure of the differing degrees to which partisan voters are geographically concentrated. And, you know, when you teach election law, like I used to do at Marquette Law School, one of the first things you do is you put up the stars and the circles and you show how you can have a different outcome depending upon how those stars or circles are distributed within a district. And here we know that Democratic voters are far more geographically concentrated than Republican voters. And this is always going to lead to a certain amount of disproportion as long as we have a system of geographical districts in which the first past the post wins. And so to draw maps in a way that eliminates that disproportion is every bit a partisan enterprise as the legislators are accused of engaging in the first instance. Gerrymandering for competitiveness under those circumstances definitely has a partisan valence to it. And so it's very difficult to know precisely what to do. My bias is that, and I think this is something that we need to spend a lot more time thinking about generally, is that we are not going to have, Democrats are not going to have, and Republicans are not going to have, an election victory that makes the other side go away. There isn't going to be a final and complete victory in these culture wars. And so, stepping back and having some concern about institutional remedies and the rules of the game, I think is something that we all could spend a lot more time thinking about and demonstrating our commitment to. Now, whether that means that you can have an independent commission is something that I'm not sure of. I am skeptical of independent commissions because in my view, they tend to drive the politics underground rather than eliminate the politics altogether. Jim Troupas, who has done so much, election districting work over the years, says, even from a Republican perspective, I mean, if we told a computer to draw lines as contiguous and compact as we possibly could get, that I'd be happy with that. We'd do okay. And I don't know if that's the solution. I do believe, and we were the ones that filed the petition with the state Supreme Court, asking them to adopt a set of rules so that we could have an original action and the court could resolve it, that this is something that is ultimately a function of state legislatures and the state courts. That's where our Constitution presents it. We filed a petition because 20 years ago, the Wisconsin Supreme Court recognized that, yeah, they ought to be the court handles redistricting litigation, but they didn't have a process to do it. They said that they would develop rules someday to have such a process. A number of years ago, they didn't do it. Perhaps they'll do it this time. Perhaps they won't. I don't know.
Thanks, Rick. That nicely tees up our first question, which is from Rob Driscoll, the former president of the Milwaukee chapter of the Federalist Society. Rob asks, what standards could or should state governments use in assessing whether maps have been unlawfully gerrymandered? For example, would they look at the total vote in the state and make sure that seats in the legislature roughly come out to the same percentage? Would they make sure that there was a balance of competing interests represented, such as urban versus suburban versus rural, others? Lester, you want to take the first stab at that since Rick just addressed it obliquely?
Let me take a step back first and say the first thing that ought to happen is the maps ought not be done in secret. That's what happened in 2011. They were done secretly, even in legislators had who were privy to what was being drawn were pledged to secrecy. The process ought to be open. That will give the public understanding of how the maps are being created. In terms of a standard, one of the things that as Rick talked about briefly is we have compact and contiguous districts. And I think we need to focus on that issue. Now, we know that Democratic voters are heavily concentrated in urban areas. Democratic voters, for example, are in urban areas everywhere around the state. And the current map that we have, for example, carves out parts of urbanized places all over the state and created strange districts which exist for the purpose of keeping the opposite party voters from having influence within that district. That's a standard that I think we ought to look carefully at. That is, are these maps abandoning the notion of compactness and contiguousness, or I think that's the right word, being contiguous, and using that as a basic standard. Justice Roberts called in the Gill versus Whitford case the statistical analysis that was presented to him as social science gobbledygook. Apparently, that would be the response to try and coming up with any kind of statistical formula. I do want to just say, parenthetically, my older daughter is a professor at Duke. She's a social scientist, and what she does is not gobbledygook. I just want to get that out there. But I understand that that's the way people see these things, and I don't think we can ever come up with a statistical, social science-based standard that will satisfy anybody. But if we think we go back to the original concepts of how districts are supposed to be drawn, they can be drawn fairly and accurately.
Rick, anything further on this subject?
Yeah, I don't know if social science is gobbledygook, but oftentimes it seems like a Tower of Babel. There are two things that Lester, or one thing that Lester referred to, which I think makes this more harder, is he talked about community of interest. And the problem with traditional redistricting principles is they work across purposes to one another often. And community of interest is a principle, right? That is a recognized principle for drawing a district. Well, you know, if it's a community of interest, you might do things like putting the cities of Racine and Kenosha together, distinct from the suburban parts of Racine and Kenosha, and that could have a partisan impact. I mean, the other thing that happens here is is the impact of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which has been interpreted to impose under certain circumstances an obligation to draw districts in a way which maximizes the opportunity for minority voters to elect candidates of their choice. And it is sound doctrine that oftentimes you got to pack them in there, pack minority voters in order to make that happen due to assumptions of lower turnout rates. And then, you know, you have a problem at that point because the very thing that is often attacked in redistricting litigation, which is packing Democratic voters, is something that is then being compelled by another aspect of federal law. And so once again, we're working at cross purposes.
Our next question is for Lester from an anonymous attendee. If voter ID is not acceptable because it restricts access, how does one know whether the person voting is entitled to vote? And with such closely contested elections, isn't that a serious foundational problem? In other words, absent effective electoral guardrails, how can the people have confidence in the outcome of an election?
Okay, well, let me first respond. We have, in Wisconsin, a history of clean elections, fair elections, for decades and decades and decades without voter ID. But I didn't say voter ID is not okay. The Wisconsin Supreme Court said voter ID doesn't violate the Wisconsin Constitution. In fact, the Court of Appeals said that too. Fine. What voter ID says is you're not who you say you are until the government says you are who you are. Okay, fine. Why do you have restrictive voter ID laws? That is, if a person works, for example, for Milwaukee County, has a badge with his or her photo on it, and it says their name. They say that's who they are. That's not good enough. Corporate IDs aren't good enough. A person who doesn't have an ID, an affidavit from a person who does have an ID saying, I know this person, this is who this person is. Do we really believe that there's such a problem that you couldn't expand what's an acceptable ID? You really believe that people would come in, for example, in an affidavit circumstance and lie in order to get a single person to vote as if they were somebody else? Because they have to know that the person who they're impersonating isn't going to vote or hasn't already voted. You don't need as restrictive a voter ID law as you have in Wisconsin. You don't need as restrictive a student ID law as you have in Wisconsin. Why did you have a restrictive student ID law? Why did the legislature pass that? You have a student ID and it has the student's picture on it. And they've registered to show where they live and so forth. Why? It makes no sense, except if you don't want students voting in those places where there are universities. So this isn't really the voter ID law in concept is fine. In actuality, it is designed in this state to limit the people who can get IDs and vote. That's just a fact. Well, but most people get them, most people can vote. But why should any person who meets a qualification in Wisconsin, a citizen of this state, not be able to vote? Any one person who's denied that right because of restrictive law, I think is a wrong thing. And that's just my position on it.
Thanks, Lester. Our next anonymous attendee is interested in the panel's opinion on why Wisconsin seems to have become such a hotbed of election law cases in the last decade, and maybe more broadly, how Wisconsin has suddenly found itself as a focal point of the political landscape. Rick, Lester, who wants to take that one on?
I think it's because we're a purple state and our elections are not beyond the margin of litigation. And so everything seems to matter more here. And no matter what happens, right, in a state like Should pull some examples out of the hat. You know, I mean, Vermont on the one side or Montana on the other side is going to affect the outcome, right? Because it's fairly one-sided, but it's not one-sided here. It's pretty close. And because of that, every advantage matters. And the challenge for us in the state of Wisconsin is to understand that we're engaged in a robust political battle, but also to understand that the rules of the game matter, and that institutions matter, and that we have to be very, very careful that in engaging in this robust political competition, we don't, you know, wind up damaging those rules in the process. I don't think we have, but it's always a danger.
I think we have become a focal point for a simple reason. That is, in 2011, we had a hyper-gerrymandered legislature created. And when you have a hyper-gerrymandered legislature, you get absolute conformity among the legislators. And that's what we've had. And the legislature, when it took over, when Governor Walker was the governor, took over, it passed a lot of law with regard to voting, and it passed a serious gerrymandering. And that led to people trying to use the courts to correct it. And then that's pretty much it. You know, you create a situation where people want to try to find a resolution. You can't find a resolution through the legislature because the legislature is completely hyper-gerrymandered. What do? You go to court. That's what we do for a living.
Thanks, Lester. I don't see any other questions, but I guess I'll ask one. This one is for Lester, but Rick, you can jump in too. And it's tricky, so if it's, you know, feel free to address it as you feel comfortable. But, you know, back in April when we were first hit by the pandemic and we were trying to figure out how to go about our business, there was a big fight in Wisconsin about the April election, and it became predictably partisan. But then in the months to follow, there were similar skirmishes in other states about whether duly scheduled elections should be postponed or modified in some significant way. And of course, now there's a lot of speculation on the left that President Trump might try to postpone the November election if he thinks it would benefit him. So how ought we to think about this, again, from the perspective of a neutral principle? There are pandemics, there are all sorts of emergencies that we encounter in daily life. We want our state governments to have broad powers for the most part during emergencies, at least our executives, to respond expeditiously to the problem, subject to some accountability. But how ought we to think about what rules and what discretion state governments have during an emergency when an election is coming up? As you said, Lester, you know, there's a fox guarding the hen house problem here, because the elected officials themselves are subject to election. So how would you address that? And you know, are you maybe proud that the Wisconsin Supreme Court came out that way in the April case, because now it's the only precedent standing against Donald Trump if he attempts to postpone the November election?
Well, President Trump has no ability to postpone the November election, so I'm not concerned about that. I think what happened in the spring was very unusual, because this pandemic was emerging so quickly in a way that no one had anticipated. I was a supporter of Joe Kurowski, as I'm sure people know or would guess. I think postponing the election would have been bad for her. But I thought the election should be postponed because I thought it was dangerous to make people go out to vote. And I thought that Governor Evers should have acted sooner in seeking to postpone the election. He acted very, very late, and he acted the day before, really practically the day before the election, which just was untenable, and it wasn't going to fly. And there's no way the Supreme Court was going to say that was a legal order. As a general rule, I don't think elections should be postponed. But also as a general rule, if there's an emergency, we ought to have mechanisms that we can use to allow people to still vote without risking their lives and their health. I suspect this isn't going to come up again for a while. Hopefully we won't have another pandemic. But that I think should be a general rule, that if there's something that's interfering badly with the ability of people to vote in person, we've got to have a mechanism to deal with allowing them to vote in another way.
Okay, well, thank you very much. We got one more question from Anthony Lococo. Anthony, I'm sorry, we're not going to be able to get to that because we need to wrap up here. But thank you all for joining. Thank you to our panelists, Rick and Lester, for the very elucidating conversation. And we hope to see you all here at 12:30 tomorrow for the panel on nationwide injunctions. Thank you very much, everyone.
My pleasure. Thank you.